You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Women artists have always had a harder time achieving success in the art world than men, but in recent years, a few have managed to gain widespread recognition. Starting tomorrow, the Film Forum is presenting documentaries profiling two of them on a double bill: Christy Zia's Everybody Knows Elizabeth Murray and Allison Clayman's The Hundred Year Show, starring the Cuban artist Carmen Herrera. I'm delighted to welcome the two directors to The Leonard Lopate Show today. Hi.
Hi. Hi.
Allison, you previously made a film about Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei. What brought you to the Cuban artist Carmen Herrera, who is now 101, right? And she just had a retrospective at the Whitney.
That's right. It closed yesterday after being extended for a week. You know, it really was working on Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry that led me to meet Carmen Herrera. He, in London, works with the Listen Gallery in London and New York. And at a screening in 2013 of Never Sorry, some of the gallerists said, you know, you should meet Carmen Herrera. You want to meet someone cool? She's in New York. She's 98 years old. She was 98 years old at the time. And, you know, when I met her, I just felt like not only did she deserve a film about her life, but that there was just absolutely no reason that I would ever regret spending the time with her.
She's a very likable person. It's very clear. Right?
Yeah. And, you know, I also, you know, personally did feel like Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, you know, every movie has to, you have to follow the footage for a documentary, and you have to follow the story as a journalist and filmmaker. And I did feel like, you know, it'd be nice to do something about a woman artist to kind of balance, you know, Ai Weiwei was kind of a very masculine kind of character in
somewhat,
film.
Yes. So tell me a little about her. I mean, she's lived a long life. She's a very full life. When did she come from Cuba to America?
So she was born in 1915 in Cuba to a, you know, feminist journalist mother and a publisher father, and the last of seven children. She studied painting and architecture, but it was a time when education was super interrupted because of constant strikes and, you know, protests against Batista and all these things. She met an American who came down to Cuba because he had met her brother in New York. They ended up falling in love, getting married, and she left with him for Paris right after World War II. That was where her art style started to really become more and more pared down. She was really inspired by a lot of the sort of abstract movement, Réalité Nouveau, Salon, you know, being influenced by suprematism, you know, Russian artists as well, and eventually hit on this style that was, you know, this, what she has been doing ever since, you know, these very striking, often two-color, you know, very, very minimalist abstract paintings. And that was what she was doing when she came back in the early 50s to New York, and she's lived here ever since, basically in two apartments. In the 50s, she moved to the apartment that she currently lives at now, basically at 19th and Park.
Just above Union Square, basically, for the most part.
Yeah, and her husband was a teacher at Stuyvesant. They lived, like, a very modest life, and he really supported her in saying, you know, if you do some other kind of work, then you're not going to be an artist. So, like, you know, we can live a more modest life, and, you know, if you should just keep painting. And so she painted for decades. This isn't a story of an older person who suddenly decided to take up painting, you know, not to be confused, since the film, I guess, titled is Focus on Her Age. But, you know, this is the story of a full life, of basically a full century of working.
But her early life, at least, as you depict, was She had a good life, a good upbringing. It was a very well-to-do family she came from in Cuba, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And she had, you know, training, you know, very formal training as a in painting. She did go to university, but her family was, you know, against Batista. And then, you know, when Castro came to power too, pretty quickly they, you know, realized that it wasn't such a great situation either. She used to go back to Cuba to visit her mother up through the 70s. She would tell me stories about going back, but once her mother passed away, she never went back. I actually was able to go to the Havana Film Festival last December, so it's December 2015, and show the film there, and I, you know, tried to track down where her home was, and you know, there were, when I talked to older people, they absolutely recognized her mother's name. I think she really was a well-known newspaper woman.
This is Arun Venugopal sitting in for Leonard today. I'm speaking to two documentary makers about their current works, Christy Zia's Everybody Knows Elizabeth Murray and Allison Clayman's The 100 Year Show, starring the Cuban artist Carmen Herrera. Christy, your subject, unlike Allison's, grew up in a very, I guess, difficult, home. They really struggled when she was growing up, right? Was this in Illinois? Is it outside of Chicago, is it?
Yes. I think she was in Chicago. I think she was actually born in Chicago, but then the family moved. But her father was struggled as a doing a variety of things. He was a lawyer, but he was also a gambler. And I think so a lot of their beginnings were very, very difficult. And they actually slept on the subway on occasion. So it was a struggle for her to just live a basic life. And then, of course, when she was in school, she had a teacher who thought she had amazing talent and then went to her mother and said, "I'd like to help Elizabeth study art in Chicago." So she paid for it. She paid for her to go and study at the Chicago Art Institute.
Did you ever get a sense of how her upbringing informed her path or her work itself?
I think everybody's upbringing informs something about what they do later. I think that you see it in her understanding of childhood things in general. A lot of her illustrations in her journals show young girls with tears in their eyes, just as a kind of doodle. But I think the interesting thing about her work is that sometimes her titles are more emphatic about what's going on than what you actually see in front of you. But the notion of how she started and where she wound up, I think she's always wanted to be an artist. She just never thought she could make a living doing it.
Elizabeth Murray died almost 10 years ago. Why did you decide to make this film now?
Well, in fact, I started making the film when she was still alive.
Wow.
She and I go way back to at least 25 to more, maybe 30 years ago. She was a friend of, Joanne Acolytis and I were going to do a Mormon opera, and then we went out to the wilds of Utah. And we would have people come with us, friends. And Elizabeth was one of the friends who came out, and she was a friend of Joanne's. And we met on these treks that we did in the backcountry of Utah. And then I realized that I really thought she was an amazing person. And I had been working with Jonathan Demme and Martin Scorsese as a production designer. And they had done these wonderful films about Neil Young and Bob Dylan. And I wanted to do a movie about a remarkable woman artist. And so I asked Elizabeth if she was interested and if I could make a film about her. And she said, absolutely. So we started, and it was very soon thereafter, A, that she got diagnosed with cancer, and B, she had this absolutely amazing retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in 2005.
And she was going through treatment at the time that you some of that footage you have.
Yes, absolutely. So this has been a labor of love, and also it's taken its time because, as you know, it's hard to make documentaries, as you may know. Money comes and money goes, and as we ran out of money, I'd go back and do another production design job, and then when I had enough money to go back and do the film, I did the film. And actually, I think that the 12 years, it was a good thing that I had the 12 years to make the film, because I think it evolved as I was doing it. And what you see now is, it's sort of like a bottle of wine when you open it and then you let it have some air. It's stronger and better than it was.
It's so rare nowadays when anybody sits on anything for more than a few minutes before releasing to the world. There was some footage, I think, of Basquiat I encountered last year, and you're like, how did somebody sit on this for 30 or 35 years? It seems like a miracle now when anything is not just tweeted out right away or something like that.
And I think actually as a result of showing it that way to her friends and to other people, I would get feedback that would make me want to go back in and interview more people. have more of a rounded out sort of discussion about her as a as an individual and as an artist. And so I think that it was worth the wait.
You also show some of these, I guess, difficult moments from, I think it's the 70s, maybe the late 60s, where she was a single mother. And tell us how that affected her work or just her ability to work.
Well, I think, and that's probably one of the main reasons why I was so interested also in doing the film, is that there's a tremendous amount of conflict, I think, oftentimes with women who also want to have families. And how do they stay on track as being a mother, a wife, and an artist, or and a career person? And I think that there's, depending, of course, also on the kind of work you have, you wind up getting friends to help you raise your children and help you do the things that make life, you know, worth living on all levels. And I think that her, when she had Dakota, who was her first child, yeah, she was young, living in New York. She and her husband split up, and she was in the city trying to make ends meet without much help. And so that's when the community of artists get together and they start helping each other out. And Dakota spent a lot of time at Ivy Shapiro's house and vice versa. So, and as, again, you know, she would teach. She would go up and teach and do things that would help her economically, but it would also take her away from home. So this whole dilemma is one that faces a lot of women, particularly single ones.
Allison, Carmen Herrera, is it true she didn't become successful until she was about 90, that she sold her first painting in 2004?
That was, yeah, the first sort of big sale. Mm-hmm. Maybe she made little sales along the way, but the headline tends to be, you know, 89 years old,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Sells her first painting. That was when she was shown in a group show in New York, and along two other sort of Latin American women concrete artists, and started to just get recognized. That was the, you know, she got a show abroad. She was called the discovery of the decade by, you know, The Observer. So, you know, all leading up to things like, you know, when the Whitney Museum was reopened here, the new Whitney Museum, Michelle Obama, you know, name checked her in her speech. She said, you know, museums like this maybe will help us find the next Carmen Herrera. You know, that maybe would have seemed unimaginable before Carmen was 90.
The Times Review, the New York Times Review of her Whitney Museum exhibition said she is, quote, finally getting the show the art world should have given her 40 or 50 years ago, but also they said that the show should have been bigger. Is it generally acknowledged that her work would have been recognized earlier if she had been a guy?
Well, I think there were some places where you could have seen her coming up alongside maybe the work of Frank Stella or Ellsworth Kelly. MoMA did a show of, you know, up and coming or, you know, American abstract artists, and it just, there were no women in that show in the 50s, or sorry, in the 60s, and maybe it was 59, and you know, it just seems like the work that she did that sometimes even anticipated the styles that became, you know, more popular in the 60s, she kind of struck on it earlier. And again, she wasn't an outsider artist either. She was, you know, having breakfast with Barnett Newman. She was, you know, going to all the galleries. She, you know, she wasn't, you know, on a farm somewhere and just wasn't discovered. It was a little bit about, you know, you have to put two and two together, that there weren't that many artists who weren't white and who weren't male that were being recognized as her contemporaries.
Was she angry about this, that the art world refused to acknowledge her just because she was a woman? What's her attitude?
I mean, I think that, you know, she has the appropriate amount of anger, although I guess maybe appropriate's not the right word, but like, you know, she's not stoic, she's not disengaged. Yeah, you know, she had times when she was really flabbergasted, when she was confronted with dismissals by men and women in the art world. But it never turned into a bitterness that made her want to stop or that made her believe that she didn't have value. I think it's just that, and I think Elizabeth Murray says it in the film too, you know, when you get that recognition, it's just like, it's, you know,
soul
fuel.
Food.
Yeah. And it makes you feel like, oh, that this is what I'm doing. And I think it can also take you in a different direction. And I know that Carmen has definitely, she has said, you know, that maybe not being in the spotlight allowed her to really, you know, drill in and refine the style that she was interested in, the questions she was interested in. But on the other hand, recognition could have also allowed her to develop in a different way, and we don't know. You know, she, at the Whitney exhibition, she had a couple works that she calls estructuras, which are sort of like three-dimensional. Some you could say is like a sculpture. Some is like a hanging 3D sculpture. She did a few of them with this retired carpenter who, you know, believed in the work. She paid him, but probably, you know, at a scale that she could afford. And these were really interesting works at the time. She made them from sketches in the 70s. Then he passed away, and then that project, you know, kind of died for her. She didn't do anymore, and it was partly, I think, the circumstances and the resources that were available. Now, if she was being supported by a network of gallerists and collectors, you know, maybe she would have made more. Maybe that would have taken her in a different direction.
But it was her husband who was, what, was he a teacher at Stuyvesant?
Yeah, I think he's mentioned in Frank McCourt's, one of his books about the time when he taught at Stuyvesant. He was just there for decades, an English teacher. He also spoke many languages. Their house still has, you know, books that he taught himself Greek in retirement, I think. So that was, you know, the salary that they were both living on. She did not have children. I know it's not to ruin it in the film, but, you know, that is, I think, also part of why, in my mind, why they could stay at a certain kind of scale for their life.
Do you know if that was a choice that had to do with her work?
No, she said that they tried everything.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, in the end, she is left, you know, her paintings, she has said, you know, that's what she has. That's her children. At the same time, she might have thrown out many paintings that we, you know, don't have, or they got ruined in being kept. You know, it's a very small living space that they had. And, you know, I think as time went on, if you don't have anywhere for it to go. So that's something that a lot of the gallerists and curators, you know, kind of credit Jesse with, at least trying to save the paintings. And I went to some of the storage facilities where they have, you know, her archive, what, you know, hasn't been sold in the last 10, 15 years. And they tried to do a little bit of restoration work because it was just, you know, sitting in the corner. You know, it wasn't, you know, temperature controlled kind of archives.
Do you know if Paula, I'm sorry, if Elizabeth and Carmen knew each other?
Oh, wow.
I don't know.
Did they ever live near each other? You said that Carmen lives near Union Square. I'm wondering.
Actually, Elizabeth was down on Cooper Square for a little while. That's interesting.
What I would definitely say, you know, the effect of pairing these two films, I mean, you know, the 100-year show has traveled for the last year at many festivals, and I've met all kinds of audience members who are, you know, just really inspired by her. And I think to see Elizabeth Murray, it'll just be like a double shot of that inspiration. I mean, they both have the same sort of fearlessness and fight to make their career, and I think that the stories are different enough that you know, it's like watching two very, you know, it doesn't overlap, except it does.
Now, it was it was Paula Cooper, am I right, who gave Elizabeth Murray her first solo exhibition in New York, am I right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And did Elizabeth herself open doors for other women in all the years that she was?
She has been.
Yeah.
She had been. In fact, I think that's one of the best things. She's definitely supported women over the past, and I think that she's been very – I know when she teaches, there are a lot of her students who are now her fans, of course. And she was extremely supportive throughout her career. Of other artists, particularly women artists.
I've been speaking with filmmakers Christy Zia and Allison Clayman. Christy directed the film Everybody Knows Elizabeth Murray, and Allison directed the film The 100-Year Show. Both films are opening together at Film Forum on January 11th. That's at 209 West Houston Street. Both directors will be holding multiple Q&As at Film Forum. For more information, visit our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Great.